Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Crime and criminal justice is the topic. Our guest is Emeritus Law Professor Gary T. Lowenthal at the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at Arizona State University. He's the author of the 2003 book, Down and Dirty Justice, A Chilling Journey into the Dark World of Crime and the Criminal Courts. This program, recorded on January 7, 2004, and first broadcast in February 2013, began with our discussion about the power structure in the American criminal court systems, where the judge has the authority, but the power often rests with the prosecutor.
Authority and power are different in the justice system. Ultimately, the judge makes the final decision, and if a defendant is found guilty and is sentenced to prison, it's the final judgment of the court. And so it's the court's authority. By the court's authority, the defendant is sentenced. But as a practical matter, the power is in the hands of the prosecutor and has been for at least the last few decades, and perhaps it's always been shared, but now it's pretty much in the hands of the prosecutor.
And that's because the prosecutor is the one who files the initial charges that brings the defendant to court.
Absolutely. The way it works is that the legislature, and I'm going to jump back a step from prosecutors and courts and start with the legislature, because that's really, the legislature is the part of government that determines who has the power in the justice system. The legislature, in passing criminal laws, can pass a number of laws that will cover the same criminal conduct. And so the same conduct may be defined as several different crimes, some with very minor punishments and some with very severe punishments. And in recent years, most state legislatures, including the California legislature, and in fact all state legislatures and Congress, have passed mandatory minimum sentence laws that cover a wide range of criminal conduct, some violent and some nonviolent, like drug offenses. And as a result of that, prosecutors typically, when they charge a case, will charge the most serious offense level and very often the mandatory sentencing provisions that could apply to particular criminal behavior. That means that if the defendant is convicted after a trial, the punishment that the judge must impose is very, very severe. And as a result, the prosecutor is then in a position to offer in plea bargaining substantial discounts from the mandatory punishment that would be imposed after a conviction at trial.
And a plea bargain means that the person pleads guilty to a lesser charge, something that doesn't have the same impact as the original charge.
Absolutely. It could be to the original charge without any additional allegations that require a mandatory punishment, or it could be to a lesser charge that's related to the same conduct. In fact, that occurs, Barry, I'd say in most counties in the United States, roughly 90 to 95, and in some places 97, 98% of the time.
Let's talk about the reasons and the history of the mandatory minimum sentencing laws. What's behind that?
It's an unfortunate circumstance in which legislatures have politicized crime. I think the actual roots of it started in a precise moment in American history when Richard Nixon accepted the Republican nomination at the 1968 convention, Republican Party convention. He promised that he was going to appoint only judges who were tough on crime and that there was going to be a new attorney general in the United States, and that turned out to be John Mitchell. From that point on, crime became a very a politicized issue, and every election year, beginning in the 1970 and thereafter, legislatures have stiffened punishments and have more significantly, added provisions that require mandatory minimum sentences that judges could not go below in imposing sentence. It could not be more lenient than when sentencing defendants. They also increased maximum punishments substantially. The reasoning behind that, the policy reasoning behind it was the thought that judges were too often too lenient and also were inconsistent in their decisions. And the idea was to achieve both consistency and more toughness in dealing with criminals. It, of course, has been very popular for legislators to take a stand of being tough on crime, and no one wants to be viewed by the public as being soft on crime. So as a result, almost every election year, there are new mandatory sentencing laws. But it is a false consistency that has been created. What's happened, instead of taking discretion from judges, which was the original intent, and taking the discretion out of the system so that all similar offenders would be punished similarly, what's happened is the discretion was simply moved from judges to prosecutors, who in their charging decisions and then their plea bargaining of cases can ultimately determine the level of punishment that a defendant will receive.
In doing that, you're dealing with prosecutors who deal only with charging of crime. What's your feeling from your experience about the balance that the average prosecutor may have?
Well, I think that that's a complicated question. In most urban areas, in large cities, let's say San Francisco or Alameda County or Los Angeles County, when you get into the large counties, you're dealing with agencies of a few hundred prosecutors. And so charging cases becomes tricky because you run into the same problem of potential inconsistency that drove the mandatory sentencing laws to begin with. And in those counties, the head of the agency, the district attorney himself or herself, is an elected official, someone who answers to the voters. So what we're seeing now on a nationwide basis, at least in the large urban areas, is a very similar process. The district attorney will have strict policies that tell the deputy prosecutors, the assistant prosecutors in the agency, what the rules are for bringing charges and what the limitations are in what they can do in their plea bargaining, so that the prosecutor can go back to the voters when seeking re-election and say, I'm tough on crime. So there's a centralization of power in prosecution agencies, at least in the large ones. I don't know about the rural counties so much, but in the large agencies, there's a centralization of power in the hands of the political figure, politician, if you will, who runs the agency, who must answer to a political constituency and be tough on crime. And so that's what's driving the justice system these days.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Professor Emeritus Gary T. Lowenthal from the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at Arizona State University in a program recorded on January 7th, 2004. The elected officials and their policies mentioned in this program were in effect in 2004, and not necessarily in effect when this program is broadcast. Gary T. Lowenthal is the author of Down and Dirty Justice, A Chilling Journey into the Dark World of Crime and Criminal Courts. I'm Barry Vogel. In this county, where Radio Curious originates, the policy of the prosecutor is that they do not waive time for the initial hearing, the preliminary hearing to determine if there are sufficient facts to hold a person over for a trial. Mm-hmm. And they also don't accept any plea bargains after that preliminary hearing. That's the general policy. So it puts a tremendous amount of pressure on a criminal defendant and gives a tremendous amount of power to the prosecution.
Barry, that's a common phenomenon that prosecutors use in many agencies around the country. I'm not particularly familiar with the Mendocino policy, but I will tell you that in the book that I just finished, that I just wrote and recently published, Down and Dirty Justice, I discuss my experience as a prosecutor when I left the university for a sabbatical leave. And we did just that. We made an offer at the preliminary hearing, the initial stage of the prosecution, and we told the defense, you will never, ever get a better offer. You take this offer now, or you take your chances on a much more severe punishment later on. The result of that, at least in my experience in Maricopa County here in Phoenix, was that the defendant and his or her lawyer had to make a very difficult decision about the litigating possible constitutional rights down the road, possible questions of search and seizure of confessions, making a decision before full investigations could be done as to whether or not there was a good chance for an acquittal at a trial. And in many ways, it put because of the mandatory sentencing laws, put tremendous pressure on defendants to make a decision before he or she was ready to make that decision and before having the opportunity to exercise constitutional rights. And so I was deeply troubled by that type of a policy. I'm not sure if it's the same, but it sounds like the same type of thing that you're describing.
It's very similar. But as a law professor, how do you deal with those issues?
Well, stepping back and looking at this as a law professor, as opposed to being someone in the system as a prosecutor,
But you actually look at it from both perspectives because you've been in both places.
Yeah, I look at it from, as a prosecutor, I see the world. I saw the world as a prosecutor, and I saw the world as being. I welcomed the tremendous plea bargaining leverage that the Arizona legislature had given me, just as the California legislature has given to California prosecutors. I welcomed the tremendous leverage because it meant that the system could work more efficiently. We could get more cases by it meant that it was a plea bargained system in which a very high percentage of my cases resulted in plea bargains, and plea bargains very early in the case, so that not a lot of resources and time went into trial preparation and litigating pretrial motions. And so I found it to be very effective in terms of my use of my time.
Let me stop you there and ask about some peculiarities within that perspective of the prosecutor.
Sure.
You tell stories in your book about police officers violating the Fourth Amendment rights to search and seizure. And it's the police officers who bring the information of the crime in the first instance to the prosecutor in the form of their police reports. And it's those documents upon which the prosecutor relies to make the criminal charges. So how do we deal with those issues where there may be a violation of an individual's rights and we don't have a chance to explore it?
That is a very, very serious problem in our criminal justice system, because it means that if, in fact, cases are plea bargained out of the system very quickly at this preliminary hearing stage or at another very early stage in the case, we do not get a chance to have the courts look at and make decisions about the appropriate lines that police officers should be drawing in their investigative work. And that's an important function of the courts, so that we know that the police are playing the game, going after criminals firmly and effectively, but also fairly. And we want to make sure that that happens, and that we're taking that responsibility away from the courts by the structure of the system that you and I have been describing. There's also another problem. The police reports that prosecutors rely upon to make charging decisions are written by persons who have a stake in the outcome of the case, and by the very nature of their role as law enforcement officers, want to see the people that they're apprehending punished for the crimes that they believe that they've committed. So the police reports sometimes, I don't want to say are slanted, but they They emphasize facts that the officer believes will help convince those reading the report that the person is guilty, and they may omit other facts that might be exculpatory in nature. And without a full investigation by the certainly by the defense attorney and also by the prosecutor later on in the case, sometimes the mitigating evidence is never ever comes to light. And that's a very troubling fact, and it could lead to the possible conviction of innocent persons because they don't want to take the risk of gambling on a trial when the stakes are so high and the prosecution is offering them a substantial discount in punishment.
So how do we deal with that as a society?
Well, I think the root of the problem is the mandatory minimum sentencing laws. I think there are better ways of assuring a fair and consistent criminal justice system while still being firm in punishing serious offenders.
How do we get that policy to be embraced by the members of the legislature and Congress?
Well, they're not likely to be many of them who are concerned about reelection are not likely to be too concerned about the issue of criminal defendants asserting their constitutional rights. Some might be more willing to listen if the question is presented as one of the very stark reality that innocent persons may be incarcerated. But beyond that, there's another issue that really does resonate with legislatures, and you know this in California where you're having such tremendous budget problems, and that is that incarceration is extremely expensive. It costs, I'm not sure about the rate in California, but nationally, you're talking about $50 or $60 a day to warehouse someone in a penal institution, and I suspect it's probably at least that high or possibly even higher in California. And many of those offenders are not violent offenders. They're offenders who have committed less serious conduct, and in fact, their crimes are related to drug addictions. And if you simply warehouse them for substantial periods of time without dealing with the underlying addiction and then turn the person loose, you're going to get a repeat of the same behavior. And that's costing the taxpayers money, and it's an inefficient use of public resources. Now, that's a question about mandatory sentencing laws and mandatory minimum sentences, especially when dealing with nonviolent offenses, that legislators and congressmen may be willing to listen to.
Returning to the role of the prosecutor, in reading your book, Down and Dirty Justice, I can see the passion that you described in your action when you were prosecuting Mr. Schilling. Can you comment about that, about how you're looking at it now as a professor with many years in the university, yet you enveloped the passion of the prosecutor?
I did. Take on the values of the prosecutors around me and very much embrace them and embrace them wholeheartedly when I was a prosecutor. And I see this, and I think it's a reflection of a broader phenomenon in our society, and that is that people take on the values of the roles that they play. And in our justice system, which is an adversarial system, people who come out of law school with very similar values and could go to a prosecution agency or a public defender agency, depending on where the first job is available, and don't have very strong ideological identities at that point in time with regard to prosecution or defense. But when they begin to work in an agency and interact on a regular daily basis with other prosecutors, if they're in a prosecution agency, with police officers, with crime victims, they tend to see the world through the lens of those individuals with whom they interact. And they tend to become more passionate and zealous in their prosecution. If you look at defense lawyers who may or may not start out with a very strong passion for individual liberty, for working with people who are the engaging in criminal behavior or antisocial behavior, they when they take on this work, they quickly see that their clients are people who are human beings who've gone astray, who have serious problems in terms of their background, their economic circumstances, their addictions, especially their addictions, and they feel that their client's humanity is lost in the system, and they feel that they are the only ones in the system who can see that humanity, and so they take on a very strong passion in advocating for their clients. And so you have a very clash, a strong clash of values that are a reflection of the roles played in the system between prosecutors and defense lawyers. I had been a law professor for over two decades before I took a sabbatical and became a prosecutor for a period of 8 or 9 months. And I had looked at the system more dispassionately as a law professor. But I quickly found myself as a prosecutor seeing the world as a prosecutor.
How do you see it now?
I've been able to step back again and look at it a little bit more dispassionately. I think I've learned tremendously, and I'm a much better teacher from my experience, and I think a better scholar too. But I am looking at it again from the perspective of someone as an outsider.
Can you tell us what you have learned from that experience?
Well, one of the things I learned, and a very troubling thing for me as a legal educator, is that many of the people who represent the public, and I'm now talking about both prosecutors and public defenders, at least in the large urban agencies, are not adequately trained for the work that they're doing. Young, and I say young because I'm a graying law professor who's about to turn 60, and I was in my 50s when I took this sabbatical, so they looked young to me. The prosecutors and the public defenders around me were generally people in their 20s and early 30s who were just a few years out of law school, and their training in law school was a training in which they spent almost all of them 3 years in the classroom with a little bit of clinical education, a little bit of hands-on opportunity, but not much. And then they took a bar exam that almost exclusively tested them on their knowledge of the law, but not their understanding and appreciation for the practice of law, the negotiation, the counseling of clients, the interviewing of witnesses, the advocacy in a courtroom that lawyers must do. And so when they begin their careers, they don't have very much training for the work they're about to do. And then they begin their work in large agencies, or in private law firms for that matter, and very often they're not getting close supervision and they're not getting the mentoring that they need. And as a result, I think they're not fully prepared for the very important public service that they're taking on. And very often you find I found that my colleagues prosecuting major felony cases were people who had very, very little experience as a lawyer and really didn't know what they were doing. And that was very disheartening. And I think that's a problem that I've taken back to me with me to the university. And I see that as a challenge to law schools. I see that as a challenge to the legal profession to better prepare lawyers.
Let's talk about the jury selection system. Do you think that's fair?
By and large, I do.
The way it seems to be going is that the judge takes over the questioning of the prospective jurors and allows the attorneys to do so to a limited extent, which gives us pretty much a random selection of the community, where the prosecution and defense are less able to ferret out prejudices of the jurors.
That's a fair point, Barry, and that certainly is the direction that the courts have been going. When I graduated from law school, I don't know if you know this, I was a public defender in Alameda County, in just a little south of you, and I worked in the Superior Court in Oakland and also down in Hayward. And back in those days, and this is three decades ago, back in those days, the lawyers asked the questions in jury selection, which is also known as voir dire to the attorneys. The lawyers asked the questions, and the advantage of that system was that we were able to ask more questions that would hopefully ferret out unspoken biases or prejudices of potential jurors, and we were able to select jurors that we felt were more open to our side of the case, both the prosecutors and the defense attorneys. The downside of that was, and there were two or three, and there are reasons why we've moved away from that system to a system in which judges do primarily do the questioning, and that was that the lawyers took a lot longer, and that a jury selection that would now, for a typical case, take a half day would sometimes take 2 or 3 days at public expense. Quite frankly, and as someone who participated in this as a defense attorney, I know this. Both sides would try to pre-try their case. In other words, rather than asking questions that were designed to ferret out biases, hidden biases, our questions were really designed to make closing arguments and to have the jurors thinking about our side of the case and the issues of the case from our side before they heard any of the evidence. And so we were trying to precondition them to a way of thinking about the case with leading questions and comments about the type of case that they would be hearing.
Which procedure do you think gives a more fair trial to the defendant? The attorneys asking a lot of questions or the judge asking the larger majority of the questions?
I would prefer a system, actually, in which the attorneys ask the questions, but one in which their privilege, and I don't want to say right, their privilege to ask questions could be curtailed or could be monitored closely by judges who, if the judges believe that the attorneys were abusing their privilege by trying to pretry their cases rather than ferret out biases and prejudices. I do think it's better to have the attorneys ask the questions because lawyers trying a case are very familiar with all the factual nuances that are likely to occur, and the judge may not have very much familiarity at all other than the nature of the charges in the indictment.
Gary Lowenthal, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I'd like to ask you to tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately.
Well, I would say Seabiscuit. Has nothing to do with the law. It was a book that told me a lot about what America was like in another era, particularly in the 1930s when we were going through the Great Depression. And I learned a tremendous amount about the passion that people felt for something that would divert their attention from the difficult economic times that we were experiencing.
Well, Gary Lowenthal, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure.
Gary T. Lowenthal is an emeritus professor of law at Arizona State University and the author of Down and Dirty Justice, a chilling journey into the dark world of crime and the criminal courts. The book he recommends is Seabiscuit by Laura Hillenbrand. This program was recorded on January 7th, 2004, and first broadcast in February 2013. Over 400 Radio Curious programs may be found on our website, radiocurious.org. They're free as my gift to you. I hope you enjoy them. The phone is 707-462-6541, and email is curious@radiocurious.org. Christina Onnestad is our assistant producer. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.